I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with John McClure, Charles G. Finney Professor of Preaching and Worship, about his recently published book, Mashup Religion, Pop Music, and Theological Invention. John, thank you for being willing to be interviewed.
Glad to be here.
And I do need to start off by publicly thanking you for all of the audio support that you've provided. This interview series wouldn't exist without your donation of time and equipment in the past. So,
not a problem.
Thank you.
Enjoyed every minute of it.
Great. You're a professor of homiletics.
Indeed.
So how do you come to be writing a book about pop music? How did pop music become so central to your thinking?
Well, you know, there's in the book I've got this long, probably overly long-winded preface or beginning of the book. I talk a lot about the fact that I've been ensconced in the world of the making of popular music for some years. I was in my late high school and early college years, I was apprenticed to a studio engineer in Birmingham. Really thought that at one point that's the world I wanted to enter, was to be a studio recording engineer. I was involved in writing radio jingles, did studio work on bass guitar, keyboard, that kind of stuff for some years, and then went on into ministry and then into teaching. And so it's... And over the years, I've played in all kinds of pop music groups. I have a daughter who's extremely talented and still continues to actually let me play the guitar behind her in her little band and so on. So I've been involved in that world for some years. And then with this God in Music City project, the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture a few years back created a collaborative work group called Music, Religion, and the South. And we spent about 3.5 years doing research around music, the interface between music, religious identity, and Southern identity, and then did this project called God in Music City, where we re-engaged my recording skills in going out and doing some audio recordings of musicians all over the city of Nashville, and tried to think through who we are as a community. The range of different identities that come through our music. So just an ongoing, and for years, it's interesting how many analogies I've used from music and from pop music making in my teaching. I never had sort of sat down and tried to catalog what those analogies were, but the more I began to come back into using music and doing research into contemporary forms of music and music making, more aware I was of how many metaphors that I use in my teaching that are completely and utterly musical in nature. So, or that grow out of the technologies for music making today as well. Sequencing, sermon sequencing, coding, all these kinds of things really have analogs. So anyway, this book, you know, in many senses makes a lot of sense for me. And I think also as I... you know, get into my late 50s, began to think, you know, are there bits and pieces of your broader identity that are not showing up in your teaching and in your writing? Mm-hmm. And at this point, thought it might be a great time to sit back, reflect, and actually produce something out of that. So, mm-hmm. And it was great fun.
Yeah. Well, our conversations about it have been fun. So, I guess to just clarify a couple of terms before we get into the discussion. Yeah. We'll talk a bit about mashup later, but your subtitle is Pop Music and Theological Invention. So if you could tell all the listeners, what is pop music?
Right.
And what do you mean by theological invention? What is
Those are really good questions. There's so much debate about, you know, what is pop music? What's its best meaning and so on. And so in this book, I really try to limit and focus it in on really music that is, and in part, I have a real genuine purpose for this, but for me, it's music that's produced with broad audience, you know, with with mass audiences in mind. In other words, I'm trying to address the sort of heteronomous element within human communication, that which tries to relate it to the world of others. And so it's music that's produced not so much with a particular kind of elite listener in mind, though there are many different kinds of elites, obviously, but those that are for mass consumption, the things that are going to be marketed broadly. We know there are going to be market niches for anything, but music that's produced. And then the other sense is that music that is generally a part of the sort of ordinary life of within mass culture. So it's, I don't have any sort of strongly hyped view of pop music. There are lots of arguments about the nature of it. So, and I try to boil it down to sort of a broad range of genres that could include anything from, you know, heavy metal to, you know, punk or, country. So I don't mean by pop what you would, would mean within the sort of genre cataloging. I include within popular music a range of forms that are popular in their nature. The word invention is sort of multifaceted for me. You know, in teaching homiletics, of course, I am involved a lot with rhetoric as a sort of sub-discipline or part discipline or contributing discipline. And so invention within that format, within that context, means simply deciding what to say. Mm-hmm. So it has to do with the whole practices involved in deciding, for instance, what to preach or what to say as a theologian. So that's a key piece for this, is that whole process of deciding what to say. But I also have in mind some other contexts. Invention within a legal context generally means discovery, something that's been discovered, patented. It has to do with patent law. Mm-hmm. So it has to do with the dynamics of discovery itself. So how do those who are composing theology at the interface between academia and popular culture, which could be preachers, theologians of any stripe, people involved in teaching, advocacy, any number of things, you know, how do we go about exploring, you know, what modes of exploration within a highly technological society, for instance, are we involved in today for discovering what to say and then how to say it. The how to say it piece is a piece of invention as well, though it tends to get into what rhetorical theorists like to call organization and so on, but it's still partly hooked up with invention. A couple of other contexts. Another way of coming at invention is through beyond the legal view is the musical view. You know, in music, invention has to do with actually finding new forms. And this, for me, becomes the whole business within our technological culture today of what I call stylistic morphing. That indeed, we're in a generation where new forms of music are being developed by morphing styles that already existed. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in that aspect of invention, whereby new or and so it's beyond simply new forms like folk, rock, and so on, into sort of morphing on those particular styles. And then finally, there's a historical view of invention. And for me, this is the whole business of actually the way in which historians, for instance, invent movements and traditions. At particular moments, and for me, this relates to the, so you have something like Occupy Wall Street, for instance, that, and then we begin to, as a culture, sort of crowdsource that idea, and then we all generally decide maybe that needs a holiday or a flag or a symbol, you know. So we begin to sort of invent it as, you know, as a discrete moment in history. In the same, and this happens with music too. You know, there's, you know, Baroque music, and there are certain symbols and signs that cluster to that. So this, for me, gets into the whole business of how music, the value of music it's a typical word today, crowdsourced within the sort of nets and flows of pop culture, Facebook, the ways in which we sort of create. As a community, events through the ways in which we actually receive it, organize ourselves around
Twitter
it. Yeah, Twitter it, decide that it's important. You know, yeah. It's important that Tebow is doing this, that, or the right. other today, and so on. So there's an inventive aspect just historically around certain kinds of music and certain kinds of theological communication also.
So invention is, I mean, all of, for
it's
you,
a
for
lot.
What you're writing is all of these different kinds
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, and I kind of weigh into different aspects of it at different points in yeah. the book. You know, it's kind of, so it's not like I'm trying to go full tilt on all of these at all points.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a multifaceted word. It's a really richly textured word.
Mm.
And there's some concern in homiletics today that we don't do enough with practices of invention in this broad sense.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a kind of a lockstep nature to it. Grab the Bible, find a big idea. You know, we don't talk about how that works. That whole process, just you know, if there's a significant idea there, you know, and then just sort of preach it. So these old practices of invention are sort of subsumed under the exegetical
mm-hmm.
process and so on. So there's concern within our guild around this that I think going forward will get more and more attention, perhaps.
And you're kind of lifting out different possibilities of understanding the term and then
yeah.
ways of inventing.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, and ways in which we can kind of think about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's different if you come from the side of creating a work than if you go to the side of how a work is going to be received and crowdsourced, if you will.
Right.
So there are ways of coming at that whole topic of invention. You know, what's the historical kairos and epoch for this, you know, that calls for something to be said?
Mm-hmm.
But then there might be on just your basic writing side, basic practices like, well, I probably ought to have a Bible in one hand and a theological book in the other, and maybe newspaper as well. You know, so, you know. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There's lots of different pieces of it.
Before we get into the contents of the book in a deeper fashion, I wanted to talk about a perception that I had as I was reading the book, which was how you were relating music and theology. The way that I was reading your book, it seemed that, particularly at the beginning, songwriting and song making were set up in analogous form or models, analogies
right.
for theological invention.
Mm-hmm.
So for, you know, a songwriter, just as a songwriter does this, so a theologian does this, just as a songwriter,
right.
you know, could do this.
Right.
Look, a theologian could be doing this kind of thing
right.
too. But then as the book goes on, it seems like these two ideas, well, these two whole worlds of, you know, songwriting and theology
right.
sort of come together until at the end of the book we get an engagement between theology and musical lyrics. Did you intend this kind of move, or is this just something I'm seeing?
No, you're seeing it, and it struck me at first as being a kind of dislogic or a missed logic, because I felt like by the end of the book I was, you know, I had gone to the point where I was engaging, you know, trying to actually help us see how theologians, how music is in fact, especially forms of pop music today, contain theology, and we can think theologically, mm-hmm. and to help, you know, create a kind of portable form of rhetorical analysis, if you will, for pulling theology out of pop music. And I worried about that, to be honest with you, because that seemed like, well, that's a different book. But the more I got into this and worked through it, it became clearer to me that, to some extent, towards the end of the book, I talk about this a little bit as a jump from a sort of descriptive and then analogical kind of thinking toward a more missiological thinking. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to thinking about the whole business of composing in and for popular audiences, it became clear to me that a big piece of what we had to be doing as theologians was a kind of ethnographic study. We learned, and that for me involved learning how to read audiences. So we needed some basic tools to think about how to really know what fan, you know, what a, that's just a broad word there, what our fan culture might be and might be looking for from us. But also we needed to know how to read lyrics, and so to have some form, some way of coming into, and so for me that kind of, so it's kind of hooked into almost into congregational studies type of literature and and ethnographic research. How do we locate ourselves as theologians so that we can begin to that our theological composition can have some real uptake, if you will, and but also where we can contribute something back. So that's the kind of missiological piece. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of wanting to say, in this mix, people are looking for certain things. Mm-hmm. We don't know what those things are until we know them. So we got to find a way to really know them. We might know something more about them through their music. You know, if you're a Johnny Cash lover, you might be generally looking. You know, that's reaching into different things within life and raising different kinds of questions and so on, then if you're a Madonna fan or a Lady Gaga fan, you know, where other issues and concerns are there for you. And so and that's one piece of what I like to call the sort of mattering maps that fan cultures tend to show us within a person's life. So if you're I really kind of moved towards the end of the book away from drawing the direct analogies toward composition, in part because I'm at that moment within composition where thinking about reception is so important. Mm-hmm. So I haven't abandoned the analogy. It's the same kind of thing that musicians do when they're at the end of creating an artifact, right? They start to ask questions in the mastering phase, especially about, so what's the, you know, where does this go? Who's its audience? How do we, you know, what sound palette do I want, and how does, and that is at that bridge, you know, and then they're also, you know, online, you know, with cdbaby.com and Facebook and MySpace, you know, cultivating that particular culture itself, which also means they have to get out and know it. Mm. So the analogy is still there, but it gets a little rougher, I think, at the end.
Yeah. Okay. Another kind of structuring thing that I noticed, and I'm just going to mention it, but then ask a question sort of related to it. Your book seems to follow the development of a song. I mean,
that's right, exactly. I thought that would be easy.
Yeah, right?
So that
our audience kind of has a sense of the sort of the larger structure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it starts with talking about the songwriter composing the song, and talks about its evolution in the studio,
right,
or it's tracked and sampled and remixed and mashed up.
Yep.
And then you talk about audio characteristics, and then, as you were just saying, you know, how is it received by the audience,
yep,
the fans, the fan,
right,
cultures,
yeah,
and these fans interpret these texts, these songs, in various ways, and one way is through,
right,
the lyrics. Central to all of this, behind this structure, but central to your discussion, is the whole concept of tradition.
Right.
What do you mean by tradition?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, in this book, there's this movement from different ways really of relating to tradition. And for me, a tradition is in its deepest sense, I think traditions are cultural negotiations with sacred texts. I mean, that's a lot of the way that we think about it in a Western sort of context, that, you know, we're, you know, how do we negotiate meaning and truth? And generally that's done in relationship to things like, you know, the Bible and constitutions and documents of all sorts that we hold to be. But I think but in this book I'm talking about traditions the way that a musician would talk about it, tradition, and that is, what are our roots? How do we think about the ways that that those foundational events it could be the emergence of a new form of music itself, you know, so that if I'm in a blues tradition or a certain kind of jazz tradition, I'm going to have certain voices and people sort of who are the central kind of exemplars of it. So what I feel like, the more I thought about this in terms of the book, what I felt like was happening, or what I saw, was a different way of relating to these traditions out of which genres grow. I mean, of course, the blues tradition has given rise to multiple genres, you know, rock and rockabilly and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of different. But the ways of relating to these traditions, and of course for us, the Christian tradition, which has its own range of different subcategories and traditions as well. But the way of relating to these traditions seems to shift as one moves on into the recording studio. Mm-hmm. And so the first chapter on the songwriter really focuses so much on a way of really wanting to absorb and live into a tradition. You know, most songwriters are spend hours, and they collaborate even with those who are like them in order to really make sure they get, and so they learn how to cover and style on and within a particular tradition of music. But then what I felt like I was noticing as you get into studio practices, especially by the time you get to sampling and sequencing and so on, and the music of the DJ, is a very different approach to tradition, where a tradition becomes a resource for for what they call breaks and beats that can be placed alongside similar breaks and beats from wholly other traditions. So this kind of much more widely, a much broader view of how of what traditions are and how they function is a lot more of a almost pastiche way, rather than cutting and pasting, piecing together, building in as needed, realizing what those sounds do. However, this is the interesting thing: there is a real sense about what. So, for a theologian, the language of another tradition, theological tradition, or even another religion, has a different sonic palette, a different sound, a different feel to it. You know, so there's real intentional and real self-consciousness about it. But it's a different approach to tradition and how it, what it means and how it works. So I felt like there was that was not something I came to the table with. It was really one of the sort of inductive learnings. I really felt like I needed a way to start to think about that. So whether the categories I use are the correct ones or not, I needed some way to help the reader notice what happens when what's the differences between what a songwriter is doing in relationship to a tradition and what a DJ is doing in relation. They're very different things. And they signal huge cultural shifts, I think, for us.
And that, if I'm understanding you, that the first kind of tradition you were talking about, you label sort of a hermeneutical tradition.
Right. Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, particularly about, you mentioned covering. I wonder if you could talk a little about covering in relation to this concept of a hermeneutical tradition. And also, people may know what it may or may not know what it means with regard to music, but, how does it work with theology?
Exactly.
So to get the connection going between the pop music and the theological invention.
There's a lot in that. Well, it's, when I interviewed, when I read the interviews, I read about between 80 and 100 interviews with songwriters, just to kind of get a feel for their basic kind of habitus, practices, and so on. It was stunning to me that at the heart of what most songwriters, songwriters always are talking about the masters, those who, look at an interview with Jack White, and he holds up a record of an old Sun House album, and he just worships it. The way he's holding it in his hand, he grips it with, and he just looks at it with this longing in his face. So there's this deep sense. So I'm using Gadamer's notion of hermeneutic in this sense that you know, you can only even know what a form is, you know, what a in terms of communication, in as much as you live deeply into a tradition and all of its masters, those who are the geniuses within it, are hugely important to you. And then these artists not just talk about these masters, but then they talk about how important it is to do what they call covering these people's work. So Jack White will pull out his guitar and do you his rendition of one of Son House's songs. And it'll be mimetic, you know, he'll be imitating it, but then he'll style on it, and then he starts styling on it, and pretty mm-hmm. soon it sort of turns into almost a rockabilly Son House, you know, with a little bit of Clapton edge tucked in around one lick, I mean, just a slight bit, you know, a little bit of some other art, so you can feel him, but all within a tradition, right? Mm-hmm. And he would, and for him there would be no way for you to then receive that music or critique it, right? Unless you were within that tradition. Mm-hmm. So there's a touch of an elite quality in that, right? So you're really only going to know what I'm doing in as much as you know the blues, mm-hmm. right? And if you really, and also if you really know what Son House did, mm-hmm. and so the best music critics, right, are those who can really, you know, and so for me, you know, but I think there's a lot there for composing, right, theologically, you know. So in homiletics classes, for instance, you know, how much time do we spend covering the work of great preachers? You know, do I give my students assignments, you know, that they're, do they hold up little audio recordings of whoever, you know, Fred Craddock or Barbara Brown, you know, and just with these longing looks in their eyes, and then try to cover bits and pieces of that just to kind of, now in the Black tradition, you get a lot of this. There's a kind of mentoring and a lot of Black preachers learn these tropes, right? Mm. And they're tropes that are passed along for generations, right? That's getting away from some of the Black church traditions. I think the mega church and other things take some of these things away. And you wind up with more narrowly stylized models of communication. But there are ways in which these things, I'm just trying to think of a way of learning preaching there mm-hmm. that actually engages it at that level. So in a theology class, you know, I would say, you know, if you were thinking about doing, you know, learning theological composition, you know, why not? And this is what great songwriters, you know, in songwriting classes have students do. They actually have to write the lyrics of other writers if you're going to learn lyric writing. So to sit and write, literally write out what a theologian has written, just to get the feel for how that kind of theology is written. Hmm. So if you want to do Reformed theology really well, take a couple of paragraphs of Calvin and actually write it, and maybe even speak it, render it from the inside out. Find the way the language works, find the way the logic works, now obviously in translation, but you're thinking about ways in which, you know, you live into that tradition. So that's, for me, a deeply hermeneutic model. And this is like theologians who want to produce theology in a tradition or out of a tradition. Then you begin to style on it, you know, the way Jack White would. Now, when you get to thinking about tradition from a, you know, within a broader context, you know, from within, as a DJ thinks of it, then it begins to change. You know, I've got multiple traditions. I go into the basement of a large record store, all this vinyl, and I start to find incredible breaks and beats from all kinds of traditions. And I'm relying on this kind of incredible sort of audile technique that I've got for listening to these things. This is a playlist generation we're in now, right? People, you know what works. So people don't, the album's dead, right? That's all within a genre. That's old, the old tradition stuff. Now it's, I got this cut and I got this other one from over here. That's the DJ mentality. But they work side by side, and I know how they work, and the better I am at sort of creating this way of putting these, of juxtaposing these things from across maybe multiple genres of music, perhaps, then the better my my playlist CD is for you that I'm going to give, you know, that I'm going to give you. So, and this is the way a DJ works. So it's a little different model. So then we're into sort of thinking about modes of collaboration in writing theology, mm-hmm. that you know, different kinds of modes of collaboration, letting others remix my work, you know, take what I've got, do something different with it, you know, this whole, so I get into this whole file sharing mentality where, mm-hmm. you know, tradition becomes something which is shared broadly across, and that I can then stylistically morph in a lot of different ways. It's a very different way in which, and so theology there becomes far more, as I said, collaborative in nature, more involved in trying to get my ideas remixed by others, and vice versa. Everybody's got is blogging and wants to get reposted by somebody else. So this is a very different world. So traditions are sound bites, cut and pasted, put in different contexts. Mm.
This is what you call the move towards intertextuality.
Yeah, for lack of a better term, then we move from a sort of hermeneutical view of treating tradition into one that's more, and I'm using the sort of notion of dialogism from Bakhtin's work a little bit and Kristeva's work, where she uses the term intertextuality, but where we see ourselves at this sort of intersection of just multiple voices, and we see that more starkly. I mean, it's happening all the time, but I become really intensely aware of that's my locus. Religion then becomes a kind of a mashup event where I'm actually creating a mashup of multiple voices from many different traditions.
We should probably define mashup here, just in case there are folks out there that...
yeah, that's true. Right. Well, yeah, the mashup is simply is a form of music that is used, it's totally taking the work of another artist and then placing it alongside the work of perhaps other artists in just small bits and pieces, mm-hmm. and creating a wholly new work. So it's not quite footnoting, and it's a little more powerful than that in some ways, in part because sometimes the pieces that are taken are styled on and are stylistically morphed. If you look at what happens in the studio, you know, the sound is played with, taken into different directions. Same thing could be true in the developing of theology. We take what's said, we play with it, we stretch it, we time stretch it, we morph it somehow. We give it a different intonation, a different sound. It's a matter of placing bits and pieces alongside of, and so there's this experience of what I call intertextuality of being located in a place where we're a highly pluralistic context, mm-hmm. And trying to then get on top of it somehow, and articulate something new. But which takes all those elements into account in the practice. So you get a DJ who's got classical music, jazz, rock, country, blues, all of which has been stylistically morphed into an entirely new creation, right? So it's a very different form of practice. So mashup is not quite what it's made to be on Glee. If people who watch Glee, you know, where you just simply take a song and change it a little bit, maybe place another song alongside of it or build it into it. It's a more complex art than that. If people want to look for something like that, you could go on YouTube and their videos. Girl Talk has done he's done some wonderful little videos on what he does when he creates a mashup. Mm.
You've talked kind of generally, in a way, about how theologians would do that. Can you give an example of what a theological mashup would look like?
Yeah, well, I'm actually playing with this some on my the how-to questions are always tough.
Yeah,
because I'm trying to sort of move us into this world theoretically in the book. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a good question. I've got this little website called Mashup Religion, where I'm playing with some of this, for instance, around the blocking, because I think theological production will take a lot of different shapes going forward, and even preaching will. Mm-hmm. So to take something like a blog, where you've got different forms of communication, video, audio, range of different things, and you can actually, the blog as a as a web form allows for you to embed. Now it limits you too, but it also allows you to embed different forms, and so you could. So what I'm doing there is I'm playing with doing a kind of heavy theological mashup, doing a kind of practical theology where I'm taking different books, just a set of different books on my shelves, for instance, and taking breaks and beats, bits and pieces of those, and cutting and pasting them into a kind of rough narrative, if you will, but also embedding video clips, sound clips, other kinds, and other genres of communication coming to bear. And then trying to think about what that might look like, but also then trying to suggest that things like preaching could look this way too. You know, there's a bit of the cut and paste of these things, and then clips, all with an internal logic to it. We hope of some sort. Usually in music, that's the beat, right?
am I right? This isn't like you're necessarily take a sentence out of one book and just a paragraph out of another and just read them and then throw up a video.
it's a little more complicated than that. Yeah, finding ways to put them together with a logic, but then bringing other when I say breaks and beats, I mean other it's a little bit problematic because trying to grab hold of bits and pieces of YouTube videos and building them into a blog, is sometimes hard. You're forced to use an entire song, or you're forced to use so. But to be thinking about ways you could do that. Or the idea, another way of thinking about mashup would be for a preacher to think about a sermon which is then given over literally to, you might give it in a singer-songwriter kind of form, a sort of straight-up form, and then, let the youth group take it and import your a cappella, so to speak, into, what you've said, into something like GarageBand, and build other things in and under and around it, clips from a Martin Luther King Jr. sermon, a break or a beat or something from Common or some great conscious hip-hop artist, build in, so you build it in and around it, so you're allowing yourself to be mashed up by other people. The mashup artist always wants to be mashed up, right? Wants other people to, it's a copy leftist mentality. I want to be copied and read, and mashed up within your, fan culture, your own world, whatever. So think about theology in that way. I don't know. You helped me think about it. It's still rather new. I can do it somewhat with sermons, but thinking about other forms of theological production, I think
it's a little bit more.
Yeah, it gets complicated. Well, it seems like
you were just talking about technological limitations, even in
that's right.
in what you're constructing in a blog, where you wouldn't think you would be running into this this kind of problem.
No, there's all kinds of limitations with the you immediately become aware of them. They're not as much there in a recording studio because you're working with that particular form. But when you start mixing, audio, video, oral presentation in all of its bits and pieces, and getting these things working together, it gets complicated. But it's not just about the multimedia sermon or the multimedia, the professor who's savvy with media. That's not what I'm trying to get at. It's trying to produce things that are... That both have this what I call hyper reflexivity about being able to get on top of the range of different this kind of pluralistic sensibility, able to get on top of that and cut and paste the bits and pieces that are really needed for a particular public, and then to do it in a way that encourages that to go forward to be an ongoing practice within multiple communities, and to find ways to make that actually happen. Now, I'm not sure all about how that happens. Musicians are really finding their way into this, this decentering of the music industry. They've been doing it for 20 years. The decentering of theology, it's been going on for the same amount of time. We haven't done anything around it, as far as I can tell, you know, to really think through what this means at the level, you know, of popular culture, of actually making these ideas, making this work within the nets and flows of pop culture. Nada. So
I'm
all ears.
Yeah. Well, another thing you talk about, which is related, is multi-track composition and loop browsing.
Yeah,
and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's a that chapter is incredibly complicated, and it's unfortunate that we're just doing an audio interview to try to explain this. But I wonder if you could give a shot. You know, what do you mean by this multi-track composition, and how do you see it?
Yeah.
How do you see theological invention coming into play and using this?
One of the most amazing things for me that always happens when a singer-songwriter brings their music into a recording studio and they're going to have other people track on it, right, is the incredible power of collaboration. So that a song that sounds, you know, I've got my guitar and my voice and it sounds so nice, just the two of us, and then suddenly, you know, you start to play with it and you add congas and you say, well, let's go, you know, in my loop browser, and loops, by the way, are just bits and pieces of music that have been sampled from all over the world, you know, and most studios, you know, or even just digital audio workstations like Logic or GarageBand will have thousands, you know, they'll come with thousands of loops of sounds from, you know, global sounds from all over the world. So if you take a singer-songwriter from Nashville who's writing in the country tradition, right, and then suddenly you start popping in congas from somewhere in Africa. Somebody has sat in the middle of Africa and they've recorded, you know, in some incredible studio in Kampala, right, and has recorded a set of drums that are foreign to anything within that you're going to find anywhere in Nashville. It has a certain kind of a sound to it, and you add that in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you start sampling, and then you've got somebody in the room who grabs a particular kind of bass instrument that's maybe not the one that a country music artist would use. It's a synth bass, right? A heavy synthesizer, and you start to loop, and then suddenly you've got something completely different, right? From what I mean, you've got the same song, roughly the same melody line, maybe, unless they really start, you know, morphing that. But so you've got so multi-tracking brings this incredible collaborative piece. You got people rolling around on the floor of a studio, you know, hitting the bass pedals on an old Hammond B3 just to get a certain kind of bass sound. All kinds of stuff that happens in this process. So all I'm saying here is that for theological work, how can we think about collaboration in this kind of richly textured way, where we're willing to take what we've produced so carefully within traditions, highly consistent to all the Sun houses and masters that we have, you know, this is very faithful to Bart, and then release it to a bunch of crazy people in a studio and who are, and this is the beginning of that remix process, right? And if it's done really well, and if these people are all really a community of theological practice, it's incredible what comes out of it. I do courses on collaborative preaching, where we just invite where I try to get preachers, you know, who are just so wonderfully trained, you know, they've learned all the best exegesis within their tradition, to invite lay people into brainstorming these ideas before they go out and preach them. You know, and they're shocked quite often to find out what happens when suddenly somebody else is tracking on my idea, and I actually allow that track to take what I'm doing to another place. So it's a way of getting more voices. So multi-tracking is all about that. I talk about this multi-tracking happening at four basic levels, just like it would within a song. I mean, it's, you know, with melody, fills, backing, and so on. But, you know, scripture, how we use scripture, culture, theology, and the semantics of our speech, the meaning, truth-producing elements. So I try to create in that chapter a fledgling kind of loop browser where how a theologian, the kinds of, some of the range, the initial range that a theologian might start looking for if they were to start to think about what they might drop into a track to create another kind of sound and rhythm and texture to a theological concept or an idea. So it's just me again. My Loop Browser grows out of my experience with preachers mostly, because those are the theological producers mm-hmm. that I'm working with most. So the ways they tend to use scripture, the way that they handle culture, the way that they handle ideas, and the way that they tend to work with theology. So obviously that Loop Browser could be broader. But for me, that signals a kind of a strange kind of, this is back to that notion of reflexivity within a sampling, you know, a mashup world. Because it becomes obvious in this process that we can get on top of our practices in a way that we never could before. We can have more sort of intentionality about how we style our theology. So, for instance, mm-hmm. I think I mentioned this to you earlier.
Yeah.
You could have someone with a liberationist theology,
mm-hmm.
but who tracks their use of scripture, right? Whose use of scripture is done in a way that is inerrantist, let's say. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew a few of these people at Fuller Seminary years ago. They had very propositional views of Revelation, views of scripture. They were just reading Amos, right? So mm-hmm. they would go down to the arms bazaar in L.A. and throw their bodies in front of tanks as they tried to reel them in to sell them to people all over the world, right? So liberationists theologically, and who use culture in we could choose a way of then using, so who find illustrations, right, that are unexpected. So I'm going to find, so my style of cultural coding and my of tracking culture in my sermon or theological production is going to be, I'm going to look for unexpected types, like Republicans who are liberationists using scripture inerrantly, right? Let's really stretch it, right? So I'm trying to give you an example. So I'm going to do all of this in a conversational style. You would think I'd be an assertivist, right, if I had this way of thinking, but no, I'm going to be extremely, my semantic style, my way of managing ideas is going to be conversation. I'm going to allow myself to be interrupted when I'm speaking, when I'm writing. I'm going to have, I'm going to have a very laid-back conversation. So all I'm trying to say is that we can be on top of these. We can grab different styles at different levels of tracking and mm-hmm. interface them in creative ways that we never would have thought of before, and which go against all of the sort of traditions mm-hmm. of consistency, right? That we, if I'm a liberationist, I really have to look at scripture. I'm going to be really interested in what's behind the text, empire, and we're going to be in a community in continuity with those who are working against empire. But, I could use scripture totally differently. So this begins to relate to that notion of different contexts, different publics, and a way of being really on top of what I'm doing more than, and much more pragmatic, obviously,
right,
about what I'm doing.
Right.
So I'm really pushing a more pragmatic view of theological communication here. So it's so multi-tracking and loop browsing are all about collaboration
mm-hmm.
and reflexivity, getting more on top of what I'm doing within a pluralistic context and being able to do it with more intentionality.
So I mean, you were talking about the Fuller students. So
yeah,
I mean they're doing this kind of thing. Without
That's
necessarily
right.
thinking about
That's right.
how why they're doing it, or
yeah, right,
they're just doing it. And what you're giving is kind of a map of
yes.
of a variety of different approaches that people can just
yep
pragmatically
That's right, pragmatically
select.
Yeah, just yeah. as these songwriters could say, these drums from Kampala, will take this song to an entirely different public,
mm-hmm.
and it. This tune could just be it would go to an entirely different place. Let's do it.
Yeah.
It's like when, or like when, when Brad Paisley throws those marimbas and so on into his song, and gets Jimmy Buffett to track on it. Right. He's moving toward a different public mm-hmm. entirely. But he might lose a few of the old school country people,
mm.
but those decisions are made. This is what the collaborative form, of writing and of composing in this way does.
Mm-hmm.
the minute I abandoned the punchy bass pedal for the org for leaning on an old B3's organ, you know, organ's keys, you know, floor keys and so on. A purist, you know, in a particular form of music may be lost.
Hmm.
You know, if you're a strict hermeneut, but within the context of those who are in this more pluralistic, you know, playlist world,
mm-hmm.
You may pick up a whole other range of folks. So it's really a very pragmatic kind of way of thinking about this,
mm-hmm.
which I know goes against the grain, you know, in a lot of ways for those of us who have been trained that consistency, complexity, those sorts of things are what we really need to be all about. So I'm really trying to push this towards another way, which I know will go against the grain for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the moving of the song.
Right. Yeah.
into the actual voicing of it, into the mm-hmm. how it sounds.
It's huge. Yeah.
And you talk about, you have this concept of the grain of the voice.
Right.
And what I wondered if you could talk about a little bit is what you mean by that. And you've already addressed the idea that you're, a lot of what you're talking about is preaching, although this also goes into theological invention beyond that. But what is the grain of the voice, and you know, how does it play out in preaching, but also in other kinds of theological invention?
Well, it's some of that comes from, I mean, the notion of the grain of the voice is from a famous essay by Roland Barthes, who wrote years ago this essay that's had a lot of uptake, and he's trying to distinguish between, really between the voice as it's trained to meet certain communities of taste, especially, you know, so you learn certain melismas for singing if you're an opera star or mm. something, and so, and it, which all grows out of forms of breathing. This is one way to come at the voice, is through a certain kind of very highly standardized training that's oriented toward a particular long tradition, sort of a hermeneutical model, again, of taste. I'm fascinated, for instance, I was very fascinated to learn that at Belmont they train singers to use both country and blues melismas at the end of their vocal chops. You know, so if they're singing, you know, the blues ones, they're learning things like, you know, these little things that they add at the end of their, and that these things, so when you hear these American Idol stars, if they've had pop vocal training, for instance, which you can get, you know, within these various, they're learning these little vocal melismas as a kind of part of their training, right? So they're actually, now the grain of the voice, but he calls that the pheno song or the pheno voice. The geno voice for him is the voice that is your body sounding forth in its own sort of most guttural way. Mm. So he talks about it's not so much a matter of the breathing and as it is the sort of glottis, the palate, the lips, the nose. You know, so he really wants to push towards and he argues that you know, these more what I'm calling pop forms of music. That a lot of these, especially emerging forms, so that when Jack White listens to Son House, what he's really part of what he's responding so profoundly to is the suffering that comes through the way that voice is bodied forth. Like Bessie Smith, you know, it's who was it who said it's as if she'd swallowed the microphone, because you can hear all of the, you know, the scratch, the grain, so that you really get in touch with the kind of interiority of sound that's there, and that's what's most important, rather than the sort of external qualities. And my sense is that if you push back and look at a whole piece of composition, this is what the mastering engineer in the studio does: is he's looking at, he or she is looking at the whole sonic palette and then doing a final tweak that's really trying to get at what the real sort of deep interiority of sound is within that production. And I like to talk about this in the book as the sort of shape that belief takes, the sort of pre-linguistic or extra-linguistic quality of which clearly for a preacher, you know, does have a sonic element to it. You know, in other words, is this the nagging voice of my mom, you know, in the pulpit? Is that the way that the sort of shape that belief takes? Our belief in this church is one big nag, you know. Or is this the, you know, the lover who, you know, it's all desire for God that's being communicated pre-linguistically, extra-linguistically. So is this the community that's our sonic palate says we desire God, you know? And so there's all these different tones which you can take. So it has to do with tonality, the shape, sort of tone of voice, tone of belief. Now, I think that's there in writing, too, you know. So, again, to start to think about the tonality of, you know, the different tone between, you know, Tillich and Barthes, for instance, the way that the language is shaped. But to think about my own writing and crafting, or the shape that if I'm an advocate in a community agency, you know, doing advocacy work, what's the shape that belief, that our core values take when we express them? You know, how do we voice them? You know, all these things are huge. But I don't think we think that much about that. These things are not things that we spend a lot of time reflecting on. But I tend to think that these pre-linguistic and extra-linguistic elements or things that massage the linguistics and help to shape them in a variety of different ways need to be thought through a lot more clearly and carefully in our context. And I think, and so in the book I talk about that, that's what you learn from the mastering engineer, or really from the engineer who from start to finish is choosing which microphone and preamp to use on the front end for your sound, and then what at the tail end, you know, the basic final mix and mastering element is all wrapped around trying to get this grain. You know, what's the sonic interiority of this music, and how can I really get that out? You know, I'm not concerned with whether you get the breathing and the melismas right. I want to get that palate, that deep palate, going. And so for us to have that sense of what we're doing theologically, you know, what is the deep sonic interiority for this, you know, for what I'm writing. Charles Hirschkind has done this great book about the blaring sermons in Egypt from the just on every street corner and on cassette tapes and taxi cabs. You know, the way that the imams, you know, the powerful sermonic element there, blasting against the Enlightenment, against the West, against, you know, all just constantly blaring forth. Now, not a pleasant sound, but there's a sonic element there that's very intentional, that trying to resist, you know, resist an order that they feel like is detrimental. So there's this kind of a tension, and having those loud, blaring, obnoxious, that's a piece of it, you know. They're not choosing FM speakers that sound, you know, sweet, and, you know, they're choosing, they want honking horns that just are blaring at you from from all sides as much as possible, you know, in order to, so that, in other words, the shape that your belief takes, you know, and the shape that you give it, you know, has a certain kind of real intentionality to it, so.
And it's the reflexivity. I mean, you're not, not that we're calling for people to start doing nagging sermons, but I mean, that would be a choice.
That would be a choice, exactly, right. You know, within your loop browser, within your sound palette, it's a little, not really a loop browser here, it's just the larger tools that you have for creating, you know, for creating a palette. Yeah, you have some choice. You know, I like to tell my students, you know, you have a lot of choice about the way you come at, you know, in the preaching effort, you know, the basic intonation that you give to your preaching ministry is huge, and it may have more communicative power than anything else you do. It just might. You know, from this project, this empirical project we did, we interviewed a lot of people about their about preaching, and they over and over again we heard they say, well, you know, pastor doesn't say that much, and I don't really pay much attention, but I love that. I just, you know, when he's speaking, I just drift off, or when, you know, I'm thinking about my family, and I'm praying to God. So it's really interesting, right, how you know, people are tapped into the sound that of you, know, sometimes not so happily as in this situation, but there are other, you know, there's the great little cartoon, the kid sitting next to his grandma in the second pew, the preacher's, and there's spit coming out of his mouth, and he's just going on up here, you know, and the little kid looks at his mom, and he doesn't know what the preacher's saying, but he says, Mom, what are we going to do if he gets out of there, you know, out of the pulpit?
Right.
You know? So yeah, kids are tuned in. We're all tuned into the sound palette.
His voice.
That's right, yeah. And I think it's true for all of our theological production. You know, I read the books of people all the time now with an idea towards the basic tone of voice in this book or within this article. I mean, we're all aware of it.
Right.
And we know what we are drawn to and whatnot. So.
You ultimately, you argue that theologians are... Their place in this whole process of theological invention, of responding to fan cultures and incorporating, you know, what others are saying, is to bring complexity, depth, and steerage.
Right.
Resourced by a particular religious tradition.
That's right. That's
to the desires that they
That's
see
right.
in pop
yeah.
music.
Right.
So how does this, what does this mean?
That's right. Well, it's the same tension, you know, that the singer-songwriter feels when they're in the studio and they suddenly discover that the song is just all over the place, you know, that you're still, but and the need to still be in there, you know, really making, you know, bringing those powerful elements from within one. You know, this is, I think, very much where, to some extent, that's kind of a metaphor for the way I think a lot of us who are theologically trained feel in today's sort of very pragmatic, fast-moving, you know, within the sort of nets and flows of popular culture today. I do want to come back to that. One of the things that sends me back to it in the book is my work on fan cultures, looking at, there's a lot of research around fan cultures, and it's fascinating research to me because so many people today are finding religious meaning within fan cultures, and the research points this up. They're going on pilgrimages, they're going to concerts, become... you know, quasi-religious or religious events in which, and this is everything from trance culture to bluegrass, you know, going to bluegrass festivals, you know, up in the mountains in Colorado or wherever. These are, in short, you know, Roger Ayton calls them pilgrimages. They are, and he uses Victor Turner's work to talk about the way that these events sometimes function in the lives of people. There's been some ethnographic work around this too. So in that context, if indeed we're in a cultural situation in which so many people are finding, you know, are searching for God outside of the sort of you know, context of parish churches and so on, and what seminaries are preparing for and so on, what sorts of issues for us come to bear in that context? And Roger Silverstone did an interesting little piece on the sort of ethics of the internet, and he noticed that that part of what's missing in this context he talks about how the internet fosters a kind of hospitality. Everybody can get their voice and their stuff out and into people's, you know, right in front of people on a regular basis, you know. People are sharing stuff all the time and getting stuff, but what's missing is what he calls a real host for these conversations. Not, I mean, he talks about how websites are hosted, but not in the really not in any real sort of sense in which there's a genuine ethic of hospitality involved in this, i.e., an ethic which includes both creating a safe space in which we can really engage in sorting through this information, but also a space which genuinely does welcome everyone, because a lot of the web presences don't welcome everybody either. So, but where we can really have a really far-ranging conversation. So in that context, I started to think, and then he comes back from that and starts to talk about the value of institutions and of traditions as well, and those who represent those in this mix. And then there's the research that points out how many people within the nets and flows of pop culture are so interested now in traditions. They want a dose of Taizé and a dose of Roman Catholic monastic life for their, within their own little house community and so on. So there's a sense in which tapping into the resources of these traditions, deep and profound traditions, is important. And so, and it strikes me that to some extent we are, and increasingly so. So I began to sort of think of us, places like Vanderbilt, places like the local church even, as nodes of complexity within the nets and flows of popular culture. You know, we become nodes where if people want sort of to be hosted in this way, but also to have the resources of a particular tradition to bear, you know, to have a resident singer-songwriter, you know, who's there to sort of carp at us and give us some other points of view. Indeed, that's, you know, those are interesting. So it gives us but for me, it's not a place where we're sort of, I don't think we can assume that we're socially constructing people's religious reality in some all-consuming or strictly tradition-centric way. Mm-hmm. The data doesn't show that that's happening or it's even possible. People are patching us into their mattering maps, their maps of what matters, as one component. Within the range of fan cultures, church that people attend to, you know, if they patch us in at all, you know, we're one among many. It's the world of mashup religion. That's what the book is trying to get at. So for us to think about how we're going to have a meaningful presence involved us in thinking about adding some depth to people's searches, what they're doing, complexity, you know, and that's where our knowledge of our own traditions is really important, but also some steerage in and through the sort of networks and flows of popular culture. So that gets me into that sort of, and that's sort of at the end of the book where I'm talking about doing some ethnographic analysis of the fandoms that are represented by the people who we work with, either whether it's teaching at a seminary or within a congregation, to do real inductive work at that level, and then to think about the ways in which the messages and ideas that we bring might find their ways into the crates of these DJs that are in our midst, who are taking breaks and beats from a range of different places and putting them into very different and unique kinds of conversation all the time. And in that process, I want us to be both good singer-songwriters, good tradition-bearing people, but I also want us to be good mashup artists as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm really pushing us to try to hold the hermeneutical and the intertextual, what I'm calling intertextual models, in a kind of creative tension.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, the intertextual doesn't replace the hermeneutic.
I think most, you know, if you look, you know, this, you know, DJ shadow, people who wander around and, you know, the DJs, you know, would absolutely say the same thing. They would hate it because there's this constant sort of energy that goes back and forth, if you will, between them, you know. And it's true in the studio, you know, to have a highly tradition-centric songwriter, you know, being stretched, you know, that those tensions are where all the really interesting stuff happens, is when you've got both of these things happening instead of just one. And that's why the mashup stuff and the DJ artifacts that are less interesting to me and to, I think, many are those that are, you know, that are really more market-driven than they are really doing the kind of work that someone like DJ Shadow would do, or some of the better DJs, or Common, or some of the great rap artists who also incorporate the work of DJs in what they do. So, you know, it's kind those are the kind of conversations I really like to see happening. So I kind of come back at the end and want us to be, you know, it's a book about song making and theological production and making. So it's not like I'm sort of jettisoning where the book begins and try. At the end, I come back and want to keep these two things in a really creative tension and conversation. And for us to see ourselves on both sides. Now, I think we would like to see ourselves more on the, you know, in the hermeneutical, what I'm calling the hermeneutical side. So the stretch for me is this more pragmatic push that I'd like us to get a hold of. That's the unpopular piece, I think.
Well, I think that's going to be all the time we have. But, John... It's been good. Thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Very
thanks for having
illuminating.
Me, Chris. Yeah.
Again, I've been talking with John McClure, Charles G. Finney Professor of Preaching and Worship, about his recently published book, Mashup Religion, Pop Music, and Theological Invention, out from Baylor University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.